Welcome to Tuesday, Seattle, King County, Puget Sound, the state of Washington and beyond. For everybody that's listening on our streaming service at KVI.com. I'm in for John Carlson this morning, everybody. My name is Phil Vandervoort. I'm John's producer. I'm here behind the scenes every day with John, working on the show. John's just taking today and tomorrow off. He'll be back on Thursday. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, is with me. Good morning.
Morning. Week from tonight, Christmas Eve, Phil.
Yeah, one week, Christmas Eve.
And I'm still doing snow dances.
You're hoping for that. You're hoping for the white Christmas, aren't you?
Watch.
You have gone out on the limb to make your prediction. You got to try and make it happen.
Yeah, and I see all this atmospheric river stuff and warmer temperatures, but watch.
Plenty for us to discuss and debate on the show this morning. Coming up at 7:35, electric vehicle buses. The state of Washington's getting, I got to double check my number, but I believe it's $8 million from the feds, from the federal EPA and the Biden administration. And most of it is going to go to electric vehicle buses here in the state of Washington. So how do these EV buses compared with what we call the ICE bus, the internal combustion engine buses, the conventional buses? We're actually going to talk to a driver to let us know. The driver has driven both of these rigs, and some of them have drawbacks.
You know,
we'll get into that.
I'm thinking too about a week ago or so when we had Shelley on. Mm-hmm. From Open RV.
Oh, right, Open Road RV.
And talking about, the push now for emissions, what California's doing.
You know, big requirements that RVs now have to be EV.
Yeah, and she was just says, Phil, Mark, John, we're all in the dark on this, and how do you build it and go on a vacation knowing maybe after 200 miles you got to charge that thing up? And, think of one of those big old fifth-wheel trailers with a pickup truck being a battery-operated truck and going over Snoqualmie Pass, going eastbound up that grade. You see what the semis have trouble?
Yeah, they call it range anxiety. And then also next hour, I have something we will call Vandervoort Vindication. And I think I'm going to be vindicated for my comments that I made yesterday about the mystery drones.
Okay.
So we'll see if Vandervoort Vindication holds up. We'll do that at 7:25 in the social media sweep next hour. Let's start off with the Madison School mass shooting yesterday and another sickening display of violence. And this is at a K-12 private Christian school in Madison, Wisconsin. And the school is called Madison Abundant Life Christian School. A teacher was killed. Another teenage student was killed. The suspected 15-year-old killer was found dead when the police arrived. And there's a Seattle connection to the Madison school shooting. You were on the news shift over the weekend. Did you come across the candidate for the Seattle police chief opening?
I did not see that. I just heard the cops are excited about some kind of a push for overtime to go after DUI drivers. Interesting on the shooter, too. Mm-hmm. This was a female shooter.
That's right.
And people are asking,
we'll get into that in a moment.
And we'll get into that because the fact that people are asking, is there a sudden rise in female active shooters now in these incidents? And here we go on this one.
The Madison police chief is a candidate to be the Seattle police chief. And imagine my surprise, and I'm sure anybody else that was watching the news over the weekend saw a reference to this candidate for the Seattle police chief is from Madison. And I saw the picture, and I don't think I remembered the name, but I remember seeing the picture over the weekend as I was checking out news, and then we hear this report about, school shooting in Madison, Wisconsin, and then start to see video from Madison, Wisconsin, and it's the same face speaking to the cameras yesterday in the aftermath of the school shooting that I had seen a day before as a candidate for Seattle police chief. So we'll kind of get into that at the end of this. But let's begin with what we know so far about this private school shooting. It's a Christian school in Madison, Wisconsin. This is a WITI TV reporter in Milwaukee named Ashley Sears.
The Madison police chief identifying the shooter as 15-year-old Natalie Rupnow. He tells us she also went by the name Samantha. The chief says she died from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. A teacher and teenage student were killed. Six others were injured. Two people are in critical condition tonight. The chief says the shooting took place inside a study hall with mixed grades within, and it was a second grader who called 911 from within the school to report the shooting. The police chief would not speak to any sort of motive tonight, but did say the family of the suspected shooter is cooperating with the investigation.
So that's one of the primary questions still this morning. Here is the Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes at a press conference yesterday explaining why, at least as of right now, they're not giving any indication about what motivated this school shooting at the K-12 private Christian school called Madison Abundant Life Christian School. Here's the police chief.
Many of you have asked me about the why of this. Why did this happen? What do we know? What was the motivation? I do not know. But I will tell you this. Our detectives are working hard in the investigative process to find out as many answers as we can.
What can you tell us, if anything, more about this shooter and what their motivations were? Or have you made contact with their family members? Anything updated on that?
Sure. There's nothing new that I can tell you about the shooter at this time. Again, as difficult as today is, that's still someone's child that's gone. That's still someone that has to deal with what happened today. And so we want to make sure that we can ensure as much cooperation as we can.
Chief, what kind of gun was used today?
We know it was a handgun. We know a handgun was recovered.
And I've seen a report that narrows it down to a 9mm. A 15-year-old, I'm not familiar with Wisconsin law, but I'm guessing it's not legal in Wisconsin for a 15-year-old to have a handgun. A lot of states where hunting is common and prevalent, I'm sure Wisconsin is one of those. Rifles, long guns, are usually laws that provide for juvenile under the age of 18 having a long gun. But my understanding is that most states, you don't get to get a handgun until you're at least 18.
Yeah.
A lot of states like Washington are moving that up to age 21.
I was seeing the Madison police are saying 9 a.m. Seattle time they're going to do another press conference.
Okay.
And Phil, right off the top, a lot of people, and I thought, I got to look up this, because we did have a get-together here at the station, remember? We had an expert come in to talk
safety
about
concerns.
Active shooters,
yeah, right.
And give us basics of what to expect in these situations. Schools are still like number one, number two, and businesses for most active shooters.
Oh, as a
looking at statistics from Apex Target, Police,
yeah, for those
which
things.
The guy we were with talked to. And it's interesting you mentioned the pistol, because they said when it comes to preferred firearms, active shooter, this is interesting, 56% prefer a pistol. The rifle was second at 27%, then a shotgun at 14%. So here we go with a handgun, as you said, in this incident, with a female.
Yeah, more from the press conference yesterday. Reporters wanted to know about the timeline. And the suspected 15-year-old female student that was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, kind of what was the timeline for how that occurred? Here's the Madison police chief's response.
The shooter was dead upon our arrival, police department arrival, and no officers fired their weapons.
So suspected shooter dead essentially on arrival. And the officers never had to open fire in their response to this school campus in Madison, Wisconsin.
And again, going to statistics, it's usually once they see resistance, it's either they make decision and law enforcement are able to subdue the individual, or they take their life. Average active shooter, 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. Once they fire that first shot and basically look for easy targets, they'll try door handles. If they can't open the door in one try, they move on. And again, you wonder about the female. Real quick statistic again from Apex Police here and the FBI on this one as well. Defined as a person actively engaged in killing or attempting to kill more than one person in a popular area. We've only had 7 female shooters involved in a total of 226 incidents since 2019.
Definitely the rarity in that respect.
Yeah.
And then as it relates to the timeline, I'm guessing more will come out about that around 9 o'clock Pacific time this morning, which Mark just mentioned. They're expected to hold another press conference around 9 o'clock Pacific time. And then, I started this whole segment off with this connection that the Madison police chief is a candidate for Seattle police chief. And during one of the first press conferences yesterday, and I would probably give a quick disclaimer here. This is when tensions were running the most high, because this was a first press conference yesterday, right after everything at the school, the scene had been secured and things like that. And they were initiating all these efforts to try and get students reunited with parents. But the Madison police chief gave an answer to a reporter's question. The reporter you're going to hear is asking about, hey, were there any metal detectors? Were there any kind of security screening measures at this school? And, I mean, the other half of the equation would be, how secure is this school in a general sense? Madison, Wisconsin, I'm guessing, isn't what we characterize as a dangerous town or a dangerous area. And the reporter's just basically asking this question about, all right, are there any security provisions to get onto this campus? And essentially, without saying it in so many words, how easy would it be to get onto this campus if someone was seeking to do harm or danger? And I want to play this clip because if this Madison police chief is a candidate for Seattle police chief, this, I think, would be a concerning red mark or red flag kind of a comment based on how the chief answers. And again, this was all basically right after the heat of the moment of this fatal mass shooting at a K-12 school. And again, you'll start with the reporter asking the question of the Madison police chief, Sean Barnes.
What sort of gun-related policies, if any, were in place at the school, and did the school have metal detectors?
I'm not aware that the school had metal detectors, nor should schools have metal detectors. It's a school. It's a safe space.
And that's, you know, the yearbook answer right there, but in the real world, that didn't work out very well, unfortunately. And we will have to figure out if this Madison private Christian school had other policies in place, had security. We haven't really heard any reports about that, but that was a reflexive answer by the police chief. And what jumped out at me was, I mean, that sounds like the sort of thing the police chief would say as part of a candidate interview. And this police chief that you just heard, Sean Barnes there in Madison, Wisconsin, is a candidate for the Seattle police chief job. And that's one of the first things out of his mouth in the wake of a sickening, horrifying, disturbing, tragic shooting at a K-12 school. And, I mean, we already know that the Seattle Police Department has had no shortage of dysfunction. And I don't get a lot of confidence in that candidate being the right answer for Seattle schools after hearing that response in the press conference yesterday.
And you were still saying there's no motive yet of this 15-year-old female.
Nothing that
shooter.
The police are talking about.
I haven't learned about it. And again,
they're checking social media and stuff like that to see if they can discern anything.
Yeah, and I go back, Phil, to statistics again because of the active shooting activity in this country from Apex Officer. Monday, I don't see anything like what's the preferred day for an active shooter, so we're curious about. Okay, this occurs on a Monday morning.
I mean, to Uvalde. The Uvalde shooting happened just a couple of days before summer break was supposed to happen, and
right.
Here's one just before Christmas break is supposed to happen.
Now, here's interesting. When it comes to the month of the year for active shooters, June, number one, then April, then August, and then the month of March. December, for an active shooter incident, bottom of the list of all 12 months in a single year.
Sandy Hook in Connecticut was in December. I'd have to double check, but I feel like that was right in between Thanksgiving and Christmas as well. So John Carlson's out this morning, but I wanted to try and draw that connection between this Madison police chief being a candidate for Seattle police chief, and we'll see if that goes anywhere, but that, I think, is definitely worth discussing and pointing out. And in for John Carlson this morning, Mark Christopher there, me, Phil Vandervoort, John's producer. John will be back for Thursday's show. He had just taken plans to take a couple days off here, like we kind of talked about yesterday, probably trying to get his Christmas plans and arrangements and shopping and all that good stuff in order and seeing family and things like that. Coming up to round out the hour, we always bring on Lars Larson, our midday host, from noon to 3 here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. One of the questions I want to ask Lars is, who are the political pundits that he will actually stop and listen to? You know, for us in the news talk business, you know, we're here to kind of give you our point of view, our take, give you some context of what we think illuminates what's going on in the world, what goes on in the news. And I'll say I'm very selective about the political pundits I'll listen to. And I'm to the point where if there are people that I cannot stand listening to, I'll immediately switch stations, or if I'm on a doom scroll feed on social media, I'll just cruise right along. There are some people, like on The View, as an example. Why would I ever stop to listen to people on The View? When was the last time someone listened to The View and came away smarter and brighter and more informed? And obviously there are shows on MSNBC that fit into that category as well. Sometimes CNN, sometimes Fox. It just sort of depends. So I got to ask Lars. I want to ask Lars, who are the political pundits he will actually stop and listen to that you're more than willing to hear from to get their perspective, because it tends to give you better insight. And if you've got an answer to that, would love to get your answer on our text line at 206-421-5757, 206-421-5757, if you want to hit us up with that on the text line. And I'll tell you some of mine a little bit later when we talk to Lars. And then coming up at the top of the hour at 7:04, man, it's almost an I told you so story. And it involves a bus stop in the city of Seattle that bus drivers are not stopping at anymore because of crime and public safety problems. I will tell you where that is at when we hit the 7 o'clock hour at 7:04. So those are a couple of things that are coming up in the immediate future, and we got lots more to talk about all morning long until we get to 9 o'clock in the Markley Van Camp and Robin Show. Phil Vandervoort here, Mark Christopher. We're both in for John Carlson this morning on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Elvis time here. We had in the John Carlson Show in the 6 o'clock hour do songs from the 60s. That's why you're hearing Elvis. In the 7 o'clock hour, it's songs from the 70s, the 8 o'clock hour, 80s and beyond. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John's producer, in for John this morning, along with Mark Christopher.
I'll take requests of
picking
holiday
the songs.
Songs.
That's true.
If you got one in mind, even the hard-to-find ones.
Uh-oh. Now the gauntlet has been laid down. So, no. Yeah, if you've got a song request, bring it to us at 206-421-5757. Text it to us on our text line, 206-421-5757. We'll round those up and play them as applicable. So I'm for right now the social media sweep. Sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort, the Everett Herald News website posting that Marysville School District was supposed to have a meeting to talk about school closures. And the Marysville School District Board of Directors ended up not voting on a school closure option last night. And the board had previously said that yesterday was a tentative date for a special meeting to make a decision on which schools the district would close starting in the 2025-26 school year. So, you know, 9-10 months from now, because they have a big budget shortfall and they need to balance their budget. The board could still schedule another special meeting to take action, a school spokesperson said, according to the Everett Herald. But the next regularly scheduled school board meeting comes up on January 6th. So Marysville has been battling the same situation that the Seattle School District has. And we've talked a little bit about the Seattle School District financial mess. They do all of the social justice, woke politics, identity politics, policies in the school. They do the COVID lockdowns, and families decide, you know what, I'm putting my kid in a school where the learning comes first. Not the social agenda comes first. School enrollment goes down in the Seattle public schools, and they lose all kinds of money. Another aspect for Seattle is that they signed a massive labor contract deal with teachers, and at the time when they said that they were agreeing to this, they were saying, hey, we don't know how we're going to pay for this, but they did that anyway. And my recollection is for Marysville, they've ended up having new teacher contracts as well. I'm not sure how much that plays into the budget imbalance in Marysville, but here's the solution for Marysville. Don't do anything. Don't close any schools. Just follow the Seattle Schools plan, because that's what Seattle Schools decided that they would do. They initially talked about closing 20 schools. They at one point narrowed it down to closing 5 schools. Parents freaked out. Parents protested, didn't like what was going on. And the Seattle school superintendent turned around and said, guess what? We're not closing any schools. We're going to go instead to Olympia and beg the state legislature and the superintendent of public instruction for more money to bail out our school district, because we've imposed all these oddball policies that have prompted school enrollment to drop. And we've signed this labor contract with the teachers that we couldn't afford. And so we're just going to go to Olympia and try and get a bailout from the state taxpayers. Why isn't Marysville doing the exact same thing that Seattle is? And the roadmap is right there for Marysville. So I've been wondering about that for at least a month now. And Seattle has done this, and they're going to go for the bailout in Olympia. We'll just have to see if Olympia can deliver. But watch out. Watch out and see if a Seattle school district gets this bailout and the Marysville school district doesn't and has to do the, you know, typical belt tightening. All right. One other post on social media, and this one comes from a sports writer, America College Football Insider for the Action Network HQ, Brett McMurphy. And he posted this about the University of Marshall back in West Virginia. Marshall University has had off and on good years for college football. They've always been kind of the college football have not that occasionally has puts together a couple of good teams and has good seasons. But it's bowl season right now, college football bowl season. And Marshall is withdrawing from playing the Army team, the Army cadets in the Independence Bowl, because so many players at Marshall have gone into the transfer portal. They don't have enough to field a team that could play a bowl game.
Interesting.
And the transfer portal is something that's relatively new to college football. It comes with this name, image, and likeness provision that was adjudicated in the courts, that the players themselves can make money off of their name, image, and likeness. And it's essentially created free agency in college football. And so what happens here with Marshall qualifying for a bowl game but not having enough players to play a bowl game, you can say goodbye to college football games, because you cannot have fans. You can't ask the fans to pay a premium, to pay money for a flight to the city of the bowl game, a hotel, meals out to eat, and game tickets to watch the bowl game if the backups are playing, let alone you have too many players that decide to transfer and you can't field a team.
Risk of getting hurt, got a future already, and to make some money, so why play a bowl game?
Exactly.
Wow, this is weird. This is going to be strange.
This is going to be a serious reckoning for all of the mid-level, low-level bowl games that usually dot the calendar approaching Christmas, around Christmas, and before New Year's. And then, of course, we have the biggest of the big bowl games that are now being folded into the college football playoff that currently includes 12 teams. So some of these bowl games, cities and venues and stadiums that have these bowl games, they might get saved by the college playoff, especially if it expands to more than 12 teams. But a lot of these smaller bowl games, like the Sun Bowl is one that Pac-12 teams for the longest time have gone to in El Paso, that one is probably going to go away, and there are going to be others. Some maybe the San Diego Holiday Bowl is another one that could be victim to this.
47 bowl games now, Phil, here.
Yeah.
For this part of the year,
so
now that
we
get closer to New Year's.
The transfer portal that prompts so many players to leave that they can't field a team for their bowl game. You got to have some wholesale changes either about when this transfer portal happens, when the players are allowed to transfer, and what this all means for bowl games. But this is a giant problem for the bowl game system in college football. All right, coming up next, what are tariffs going to do to Washington if they are imposed on Canada, potentially Mexico, by President Trump? That's something we'll get into next here as we sit in for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. This is one of my favorite Christmas tunes. It's easy to pick some of the classics.
Louis Armstrong.
But this one, as the kids say, this one's got swag. So I just Love the style. Love the musical genre. That's Louis Armstrong. Is that you, Santa Claus? We're in for John Carlson this morning here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning. Thank you for being with us. We appreciate you sticking with us here.
Quick traffic note on this one.
Oh, yeah?
Mountain Pass, traction advised, Snoqualmie I-90, Highway 2, Stevens, you're cool. The big concern, if you're coming from the peninsula, Paul's Bow to Suquamish, this is the day they're going to put in the big girders for that bridge that they're working on. After 9 a.m., could be 30-minute hold on traffic. So get to the ferry before 9 a.m., otherwise you might have a challenge. That's today, tomorrow, and on Thursday, too. 305, Highway 305.
Coming south down Bainbridge Island. Alrighty.
Coming to westbound, eastbound, yeah.
Previous segment, we were talking about political pundits that you stop to watch, or conversely, ones that you can't handle. And on the KVI text line, we got a couple of early answers here. One texter wrote in, Kirby Wilbur, longtime KVI radio host, morning host for many, many years, now in semi-retirement, and still comes back to help us out on KVI from time to time. Another one pointed out, I like Ben Shapiro and, of course, John Carlson. And then one other text came in from Floyd, the truck driver. Floyd's kind of a regular texter. He pointed out on Newsmax, he likes to watch somebody named Rob Schmidt. I haven't watched much Newsmax. I'm not familiar with Rob Schmidt, but there's that recommendation from Floyd, the truck driver. I was going to ask Lars Larson, our midday host, who are the names of political pundits that he likes to stop and watch? You know, like I said here, running the radio show, producing John's show. We're trying to plow through as much material as possible, and you're looking for as many different outlets and areas as possible to try and get input on what would make it onto the show, what would be good to talk about on the show. So I come across lots and lots, and that's why I wanted to bring that up. Well, I'll bring it up with Lars here in just a couple of minutes. Another person that fits into this category that I follow on social media is the actress and author Justine Bateman. And if you're around my age in your mid-50s, I'm 55, you remember Justine Bateman from the TV show in the 1980s called Family Ties. She played the sister Mallory to Alex P. Keaton, Michael J. Fox. But Justine Bateman has turned into a great follow on social media. And she'll call out people over politics. And for instance, here's something that she posted a couple of days ago in the aftermath of the United Healthcare CEO, Brian Thompson, being assassinated in New York. And she posted about that. The murder of the United Healthcare CEO was the first time I can remember where a shooting that received so much news coverage and news attention wasn't immediately followed by a demand for gun control. Selective activism? And that is pretty accurate assessment of the media coverage right after the assassination in New York City, that there was not an immediate call by a lot of the typical players in politics or the activists in the gun control side of the equation that jumped onto that. And so I thought that was very astute that Justine Bateman caught that and pointed that out. She's one of the people I follow on social media, and that's why. Center Square does a lot of great political coverage for the state of Washington. And with all the talk about Donald Trump as president-elect being ready to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico for the imports coming from those countries that potentially already have tariffs, they talked to Seattle-based Northwest region of a global freight shipping company. And the vice president of sales is Peter Koo. And Peter Koo has been responding to what Trump has talked about with the possibility of tariffs. And this shipping company vice president talked about what the impact would be for Washington. And this vice president told the Center Square, said, there's a pretty good chance Trump tariffs would spark a trade war. Trump may not get the 60% tariff rate he's going after, but he certainly will do something below that. And all these changes are heavily going to impact farmers, and especially Washington State. Washington growers, farmers, agriculture will be impacted directly. Our trading partners will likely enact retaliatory tariffs, furthering that burden. So I think that illustrates this brinksmanship that we're going to see as Trump goes toe-to-toe with Justin Trudeau in Canada. Mexico's got a new president, Claudia Sheinbaum. So that's, I think, one of the other early parts of the Trump administration. And Trump has talked about a bunch of stuff on day one, you know, related to either January 6th pardons or border-related stuff, border security, border wall stuff. And this one is going to be right there at the front of the pack for Trump. So I thought that was a helpful perspective. Oh, there's one other thing in this story that the Center Square posted, that the vice president of sales for this global freight company was saying that the possible cost to Washington residents would be about $2,600 a year. That was the other number that came up. So kind of using that, and I think they said that it's right now around $1,600 a year, or maybe it was from Trump's first term. Yeah, from Trump's first term when this was all going on, it was about $1,600 more that Americans were paying based on some of these tariffs. But this time around, with the numbers that Trump is talking about, it would jump up about an extra $1,000. So there's a little compare and contrast from where it was during Trump's first term between 2016, 2020 to what potentially could be happening in 2025 and beyond. So there's that update. Let's see. What do we got coming up next here? Lars Larson's going to jump on with me next. Oh, I want to get to this story. How about 25 years in the making for this new road down in Bonnie Lake? The News Tribune's reporting on this story. 25 years.
This is like underground in tunnels.
To get a road built that was supposed to create a new way in and out of a housing development, a neighborhood called Tahale. And according to the News Tribune, this $150 million project is now going to help drivers in the fastest growing portion of Pierce County. Drivers in the Tahale neighborhood near Bonnie Lake have a new road in and out. For years, there was only one way in and out of this neighborhood or this development. But now the opening of a brand new road is part of a $150 million project that the Pierce County Council approved back in 2008 to provide another outlet for the 11,000 residents of the planned community in the fastest growing region of Pierce County. People that were gathered at the project dedication here last Friday to connect the Bonnie Lake Plateau to the Ording Valley. It's been in the works for 25 years. Supporters say it will bring employment opportunities that the development brings to the region. So I don't know if that means the Ording Valley is going to get more quote-unquote business development or something like that. Pierce County Councilman was at the dedication. David Morrell quipped, why would you build a community with one way in and one way out? It's just the first phase of the work that is finished, a 1.25-mile extension that connects Falling Water Boulevard and Tahale Boulevard. Next, the developer will work on the new roads, spelled R-H-O-D-E-S, so it must be from somebody's last name rather than the street and the pavement that you travel on. The new roads, Lake Road East, to create three lanes going up the hill and two lanes going down it. And then workers are going to widen 128th Street and put a new bridge across the Puyallup River there in Ording. They expect all the phases to be finished around 2027. And the $150 million project is funded by the developer as part of its agreement with the county. But
is the population number of that neighborhood needing such a big three-lane road?
It said 11,000 people in that neighborhood up on the plateau.
Sounds like employment opportunity. It's been 25 years working on the or the road itself.
And then, the News Tribune story goes on to talk about how they want to try and widen SR 162, which goes from Highway 410 south into Ording. And they're talking about possibly getting that widened in a couple of years. Cross your fingers if they could do something on that by 2028 or 2029. But this is all a repeat of what happened in Gig Harbor, in Marysville, in Lake Stevens, in Monroe, in Redmond, and the Sammamish Plateau back in the 1990s. They zoned all that land for housing, and then nobody paid attention to the roadway capacity to get people back and forth there. That's why you had gridlock over the Narrows Bridge before they built a second bridge, and how you have problems on 520 going from Seattle to the east side, and Highway 522 and Highway 2 and Monroe, or well, between Everett and Monroe, and all of that. And why do the planners not think this through? We've been through this before. It doesn't need to happen again, but at least they have this road now, 20-odd years later, from Bonnie Lake down to the Ording Valley. All right, Lars Larson's going to jump in with us next as we sit in for John Carlson. Then after the top of the hour, the Seattle bus stop where bus drivers won't be stopping because crime is so bad. Those are a couple of things coming up next here as we sit in for John Carlson on KVI. Swinging Christmas. Okay, we're in for John Carlson this morning here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, is here. And
getting
now,
Lars motivated. I hear he's a little slack and decorating his studio for the holidays.
Lars Larson is here, too. Yeah. Lars, good morning.
Good morning. You know, how are you both doing?
Just fine. I love to kind of pull the curtain back on what happens on the John Carlson show when I get to sit in for John. And one of the things I was speaking about earlier and I wanted to ask you about was we spend all of our hours just sorting through, sifting through news, media, reports, websites, everything else, try and find things that we can bring up and talk about on the show, what's going to add to the show. And so I'd had this idea. I got to ask, Lars, who are the political pundits that you take time to stop and listen to because you find value in what they say? They offer something illuminating, help you understand a story better, that helps you present it better for listeners.
Okay,
who are the people on your list?
I'll give you three, because my list probably would total 100, because you have to keep a broad reach.
Yeah.
Even though he writes for the Never Trumpers at National Review, Jim Garrity writes a thing called Morning Jolt, and it shows up every morning. And it's a great piece of writing. He's a very clever writer, so I read him.
Okay.
I read American Spectator as well, and they're very good. I read Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor who put the blind sheik in prison.
He comes up on Fox from time to time?
Yep. And he used to come on. He's so busy these days, we can't get him very often for the show.
From time to time, we get him with John as well, and he's tough to reach now. But, yeah.
He's very tough. Yeah. And then I think there are a number of others that kind of come into little special areas. One, though, in general, and people should subscribe, it doesn't cost anything to do it, is get the daily newsletter from the Committee to Unleash Prosperity.
Oh, sure.
That's Steve Moore, the economist. But he has pieces about things across the spectrum, and they're very much written at my level, at a layperson level, where you can read them and say, okay, now I understand what's going on there. And it's not a long read, but you can just check out the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, and he really has some great ideas.
Those are great suggestions. Okay, Lars, we're out of time for now, but we're going to be listening at noon when you're on KVI from noon to 3 today. And then everybody else, I'm going to give you my answers to this question of who I think the political pundits are that I like to stop and actually listen to. We'll do that up next. And then we're going to add in another story from Seattle, an I told you type story. And it has to do with a Seattle bus stop that Metro bus drivers will no longer be stopping at because crime, public safety is so bad at that bus stop. So we'll tell you where that is as we sit in next and continue along for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Lots and lots and lots we got to pack into this hour on the John Carlson Show. John's taking today off. He'll take tomorrow off, but he'll be back on Thursday and Friday. I am his producer, Phil Vandervoort, sitting in this morning. Thank you for being with us. Thanks for joining us. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, is here. Tomorrow, we'll do Legendary Lyrics on a Wednesday, so be here for that. And we'll have a fantastic song for you to listen for and identify.
Useful prizes, too.
Yeah. Exactly.
Always good prizes.
I have some crazy, wild story of the music world of why it became a sensational song. We call that Legendary Lyrics, and that's one of the things we do on Wednesdays here on the John Carlson Show, kind of wrapping up what we were talking about with Lars Larson, our midday host in the last segment. I was quizzing Lars on who are the political pundits, the political writers or political savants that he likes to stop and listen to kind of help him understand a subject, help him present that information, that story, that topic on the air for the show. And then I didn't give a chance to give mine, but a couple of the ones for me. Lars mentioned federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy, who I think, I'm trying to remember if he still writes for National Review or if he's at a different site, but he turns up on Fox News from time to time. Jonathan Turley is one of the others that I will stop and listen to, or when I need to sort out what's going on with a legal ruling, he's usually pretty good at digesting it and presenting it in a way that's quick and easy to understand and grasp onto. Scott Jennings, the CNN contributor, is kind of the lone Republican on CNN, and he has been having a field day the last couple of months on CNN with the other people he talks to that are on the left side of the political equation. Greg Gutfeld's a show that I enjoy watching. Gutfeld's out on paternity leave right now after just he and his wife having a child. So they've had substitute hosts on. But Tyrus is great on that show. He's somebody I enjoy listening to. He can kind of cut to the chase and give a little humor when he does that. And then Kevin O'Leary, I never watched Shark Tank, but I think John Carlson has kind of influenced me a little bit. And now if I see Kevin O'Leary talking, and he'll be on some of the Fox shows from time to time, and he gets interviewed on other platforms as well, but he's kind of a takes no prisoners sort of a guy. I mean, he has no sacred cows, and he will cut right to the chase on how to explain something, particularly going on in the business or economic world. So Kevin O'Leary is someone that I never paid attention to on Shark Tank. But when I come across his stuff now, I find I learn quite a bit when I hear him speak about what's going on in the world. So those are a couple of the answers from me. Let me see if we had more people. Somebody texted this, and if you want to text us your answers, 206-421-5757 is the text line, the fastest way to reach us, 206-421-5757. Victor Davis Hanson, somebody mentioned. He's the prolific writer, scholar at the Hoover Institute in Stanford, Palo Alto, California. Dory Monson, someone mentioned Dory Monson, a longtime radio colleague and competitor here in Seattle, 97.3. Dory was mentioned. And got a tab forward to the next page to get to some of the others. Sarah Gonzalez is someone. Martin, truck driver, mentioned Sarah Gonzalez and Glenn Beck. So those are a couple more that came up. And then I was talking about the Marysville School District putting off decision on some school closure stuff. And we had a texter, Jennifer, that said the difference between Seattle and the Marysville School District is that the Marysville School District already has what we call the OSPI, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, involvement in their financial crisis. And the next step, if they don't do anything, is dissolving the entire district. And Jennifer pointed out the Seattle School District hasn't gotten that far yet. So that's, I guess, a great distinction. Thank you for adding that, Jennifer, as I made that comparison. Why doesn't Marysville School District just wait for a bailout from Olympia, the legislature, the way the Seattle School District is? The other thing that's so strange is, I'd have to double check the numbers, but the Seattle School District's budget mess is something like $90 million. And I think in Marysville, it's only 20 something million dollars. Maybe it's a little bit more than that. Maybe it's between 20 and 30. But I mean, the numbers are just exponentially bigger for Seattle School District. And yet they seem to think they can get the lifeline, the bailout, from the taxpayers in Olympia. The Democrats will give them that bailout. So that's, again, part of my frustration with how this has played out between Seattle and Marysville. And Marysville is definitely over a barrel right now.
Schools have always been like a, you know, neighborhood support thing, you know.
Well, I mean,
where we grew up on Queen Anne with all the schools or whatever, and we had tons of schools.
You've got to serve the community, and this is what Seattle got into, that they wanted to pay a very hefty sum for the latest teacher's contract. They knew they weren't going to have money to cover it all. While that was happening, COVID shutdowns prompted people to take their kids out of public school. And when the student is disenrolled from the public school, that money leaves. The state doesn't get that money. And between the homeschooling, the private schooling, and things like that, Seattle lost out on all this money. And now they want the bailout. So they're, you know, back to what you're saying, Mark, the school district has to offer some customer service. And if they don't offer something that the community wants, guess what? Community is going to find somewhere else to go. They're going to find another way to get their child educated, whether it's homeschooling or
Radio station's not doing well in sales here. We're not supported by the community. Can we go to Olympia and get some support?
Yeah, right.
Keep
we
a station
that
like
luxury.
KVI
luxury.
On the air here.
Yeah.
You wonder.
Okay. Big story out of Seattle this morning is a school, pardon me, not even a school bus stop. We'll get to that connection here in just a moment. It's a metro bus, city bus stop that's shut down in the Chinatown International District, 12th and Jackson, which has been a high crime problem spot. 12th and Jackson in Seattle. Bus drivers will no longer be stopping at this bus stop because crime and public safety problems are so bad. And Como 4 reporter Ryan Sims went out to this bus stop last night, and he ended up even having to tell people, hey, you're standing here waiting for the bus. The bus isn't going to be stopping here. Listen to this report.
Take a look. This bus is going to come through here, no longer stopping. It'll be this way indefinitely as crime worries here at 12th and Jackson continue. A Seattle arterial now cut off from public transportation. The bus stop is now closed here. It's not stopping here anymore.
What?
Despite these signs, many passengers had no idea about it until we told them. You got to go down there, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Sorry, yeah.
So there's the reporter basically telling the people at the bus stop, it's not going to work. You're not getting on the bus here because the bus isn't stopping. And this decision was made at the behest of the bus drivers union because they know about these crime and public safety problems in the Chinatown International District.
Yeah, drivers that were friends of mine, Phil, back in the 80s, they were saying this at one stop. They just said they can't, there's going to be trouble.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be so much trouble, and they would tell people on board, we're going to go an extra block or so. Sorry about the walk, but you'll thank me.
Yeah. So here's that portion of the story about the bus drivers union getting involved in this decision to shut down the bus stop.
A shock for passengers that was applauded by the union representing bus workers.
These are difficult solutions, but I have to think of the safety of my members.
Following last month's series of stabbings where 10 people were stabbed in just a day and a half, the head of ATU 587 demanded immediate service changes here.
You wait, you try to, you know, voice your concerns, and you get to a point where you don't have any other options.
King County Metro agreed at once. Service is next here for so many people who rely on the bus every single day.
12 blocks just to catch a bus, you know, now. We have to go downhill. It's very inconvenient.
So that's the alternative. To catch that bus, you gotta walk 12 blocks. That's a long walk.
It's a long walk, and get an idea of what this is like. Jackson Street's one of the few that goes actually from the waterfront all the way up to Capitol Hill and beyond. You can go all the way almost to Lake Washington.
Yeah, Central District, but
So if you go up Jackson, go up to 12th, this is the intersection that we're talking about. I was looking at statistic 10 years ago, Phil. There was at around that bus stop, there was 2 to 3 homicides, 7 rapes, 65 robberies. That's 10 years ago. Last year, 19 rapes, 83 robberies, 156 aggravated assaults. This will affect Route 1, 7, 9, 14, 36, 60, and 106. The First Hill Streetcar, though, about a half block away or so, not affected, if that helps in your commute.
Wow. And as much as we've talked about the crime and public safety problems, you combine that with the lack of police staffing that they've got, and criminals get the upper hand. And that seems to be what's going on at this spot at 12th and Jackson in the Chinatown International District. Now, here's a rider in that area telling the Como reporter he's not surprised that this bus stop is temporarily shut down.
Despite the suddenness of this decision, passengers told Como they are not actually surprised.
Several times this other night, they just kept passing us, like, well, you guys don't stop here anymore? They said, well, it's our choice. If it's not safe, we weren't going to stop.
So, people in that area knew that this was a distinct likelihood, or they're just simply not surprised that this was a possibility. And it makes you nervous that you hear about the problems on the 3rd Avenue corridor downtown, what they call the Pike Pine portion of 3rd Avenue. That's continued to be a trouble spot. And I am back and forth to visit family and friends in North Seattle. Sometimes you got to go to the big box store. If I have to run off to a Home Depot or a Lowe's, they're on North Aurora Avenue up there around 120th Street. And you see some of the shady things that are going on there. And I think a lot of the problems on North Aurora Avenue in Seattle have even migrated from south of there. It was always kind of problematic up around 120th, 125th. But some of the problems have migrated south to around 100, and I want to say it's 115th or 110th, and into the 90th block there on North Aurora Avenue with some of the pimping problems mm-hmm. and sex trafficking problems and things like that. I could imagine that the bus stop could be suspended on some of those locations as well.
Well, just about 6 years ago, my golden plan, when you and John were like, hey, Mark, maybe we can fit you somewhere in the morning show here. Mm-hmm. Karen and I just moved to the peninsula.
Oh, right.
And the golden idea was park over there in Bremerton, walk on, come on up to 3rd Avenue and hit the Como Plaza and even our new location now in Lower Queen Anne. I did it for a month. This was 6 years ago. And remember now, I'm up and about here, you know, at like 5 in the morning, grabbing that first Bremerton ferry when we had two boats. I got up there to the 3rd and Yesler. And again, I was born and raised here in Seattle, lived on Queen Anne, went to school. I couldn't do it. It was too scary. Right. It was just like, I can't do this, so I had to eliminate that. Little Saigon is the nickname. We always hear little nicknames.
Yes, 12th and Jackson.
Yeah, Little Saigon bus stop is what they've named that troubled bus stop there, 12th and South Jackson.
So how fast can city officials start to remedy this? I think we heard a report here just in the last couple of days that the city of Seattle has received money to restart its DUI patrol. And it had been deactivated because they were running out of staffing. And they just didn't have the staffing. But I think they've gotten some sort of a grant that's going to allow them to reestablish DUI patrols.
Yeah, the thing is, it's grant money for overtime, and you're allowed to be a cop. So I don't, a lot of officers are excited.
Yeah, I don't know
I
how
do my work.
Yeah, I don't know how prevalent DUIs are in Seattle from a statistical standpoint, but perhaps it's time to think about trying to get some grant money or rearrange some spending, take it from somewhere else so that you can get more police officers to deal with 12th and Jackson.
And we had Metro Police for a while, which I think was an extension branch of Seattle PD. Correct me if I'm wrong if you know this in Texas.
As it relates to
and
transit?
And they were just strictly working with buses and situations downtown. Do we still have
that? I think King County contributes to some of that because I do see King County Transit Police around bus stops and things like that. When I'm driving around the city. So there's some level of county contribution there as well. Another crime problem, and I think, Mark, you had mentioned this one to me off the air yesterday, and I came across one of the reports that Como anchor Chris Wynn had, and it's in Gig Harbor at the Costco parking lot. And listen to this story about a series of purse robberies, purse snatchings, at the Costco parking lot in Gig Harbor.
An urgent warning from police in Gig Harbor about robberies targeting shoppers. Three women, all over the age of 70, have been robbed in shopping center parking lots. Police say all three victims had their purses stolen by force, and one of the victims was shoved to the ground, breaking her nose.
They're looking for an easy mark. They're looking for an easy target, somebody that's vulnerable.
And I think that says it all right there. That's the voice of the Gig Harbor police chief, that these criminals are going after older aged women and ripping off their purses. And what do we hear from Democrats all the time? We're the party of women. And in the state of Washington, for women, that means getting robbed in the Costco parking lot because criminals are going after vulnerable people, in this case older women, probably not going to put up much of a fight. And that's the cowardly criminal that we've cultivated here in the state of Washington. And of course, most unfortunately, these women are the victims of these crimes. And I'm guessing these purse snatchings aren't going to be the entry-level crime that these criminals are committing. They've committed lots of others. But in Gig Harbor, this is the other thing, Gig Harbor. Gig Harbor is where a lot of people go to decide to retire because they've lived closer to Tacoma or Lakewood or something like that, or they've lived in the Seattle metro area or Bellevue, and they will retire to Gig Harbor. Life's a little bit quieter out there. Pace of life's a little bit easier out there, and now Gig Harbor's subject to crime problems.
I'm just wondering too, Phil, with a lot of the younger kids, you know, if you have a mom or a dad, or in a case, a grandmother, because these women were like 83, I think another one was 72, 71.
To 80s. Yeah.
What would you find in a purse? of somebody of that age. I would think by now we would work with family and older and elderly and the upper ages of retirement, saying when you do go out, be limited what you put in your purse, be limited about amounts of money that you take.
Just more evidence that Democrats in control of Olympia and the law and order, crime and justice in the state, they're ready to have the collateral damage of older women getting robbed in Costco parking lots. At least that's what it looks like based on these crimes repeatedly happening in Gig Harbor at the Costco parking lot. In for John Carlson this morning here, I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer. I'm Mark Christopher, the radio legend, is with me as well. Up next, it's a social media sweep, but the report is going to be called Vandervoort Vindication. It has to do with some of the drone mystery videos that are circulating and questions that are permeating about what's up in the sky. Is that a drone? I think I've got some Vandervoort vindication, so we'll do that next. And then coming up at the bottom of the hour, EV buses are starting to make their way more prevalently across the state of Washington. We're going to talk to a motor coach driver who has driven both the diesel internal combustion engine buses and the EV buses. We'll see what he has to say about this looming switch to EV. So that's all ahead here directly on The Commute with Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Fool if you think it's over.
Okay.
This is his Christmas song.
Kind of got that gravity.
Driving home for Christmas.
It's got a smoothness to it. Chris Rea, huh? Okay. All right. Chris Rea singing Christmas tunes here. It's the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hi, everybody. I'm John's producer, Phil Vandervoort. Thank you for sticking with us this morning. Thank you for being here. Appreciate you checking us out this morning. We've been taking KVI listener comments on the text line at 206-421-5757, 206-421-5757. It's time for the social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. I want to call this story Vandervoort Vindication. Yesterday on the show, as we were sitting in for John Carlson, talked about the drone sightings and the mystery drone videos and all the question marks that were arising from that. And my response yesterday was, I think we got to keep in mind that the most likely answer is the simplest answer, and that a lot of these sightings are going to be planes, other planes. And just because you have a smartphone that can record video and it's grainy and difficult to see at night, and you just chalk up lights in the sky to must be a drone, and you post that video to the internet and, you know, post a comment about mystery drone, what is this in the sky? That there are likely very easy answers here, but everyone starts pointing their camera towards the sky and getting video of these lights in the sky, and we kind of lose track of what the most likely answer is. Well, in New Jersey, you remember the story of their Senator Bob Menendez, who basically got forced out of office in a corruption scandal and conviction, and the senator that took his place is a guy named Andy Kim. He's just been sworn in as a New Jersey senator, and New Jersey is where some of these sightings have occurred. So Andy Kim, in a series of posts on X over the weekend, reported, last night I went out with local police to spot drones flying over New Jersey. Here's what I saw. He says, we pointed to lights in the sky moving low over a tree line. Sometimes they were solid white light, others flashed red and green. We oriented ourselves with a flight tracker app to help us distinguish what was going on with airplanes that were actually part of air traffic patterns. We saw about 5 to 7 lights at a time that were low and not associated with aircraft we could see on this tracker app. Some hovered while others moved across the horizon. We saw a few that looked like they were moving in small clusters of 2 to 4 objects. But then on Sunday night, this newly elected senator had posted a follow-up and seemed to clarify what he saw. And he writes, after more analysis and help from civilian pilots and experts in flight data, I've concluded the possible drone sightings that were pointed out to me were almost certainly planes. And that kind of comes back to what my answer was yesterday, that the most likely answer is the simplest answer, and that these are planes. Small planes, light planes, you know, your Cessnas, your Pipers, those types of things. And I even indicated yesterday when I was talking about this as we sat in for John Carlson that I was watching, you know, news video where they were taking video that was posted online and showing it. And the videos that were showing up in news stories, network news stories, for instance, were very clearly planes, larger planes, and not some of these drones that have caused so much of this questioning of what's up in the sky? What's going on up there?
Well, a lot of us are looking up that we don't normally look up, and now we're looking for lights and anything we see. Oh, yeah. Phil, there's a drone. See, yeah. Look at it. I'm looking at one right now.
So, like I said, most likely answer is going to be the simplest answer.
Yeah. So FBI, though, you see, they're saying pilots now are getting hit with lasers.
Yeah, that's always been a problem, though.
Right, and they're saying, okay, no lasers, you know, and certainly do not be shooting at any lights in the sky. A warning already from the New Jersey area from a note on the FBI.
The state of Washington is getting millions of dollars for EV vehicles, but buses, and in one case, a garbage truck. So the state's getting $8.4 million to buy 28 electric vehicles. We wanted to hear from a bus driver who has actually driven these EV buses to find out if there are any differences, how they operate, how they work, and whether or not they're going to be the answer as Governor Inslee and Democrats in the Olympia legislature that imposed the Climate Commitment Act want to get rid of internal combustion engine vehicles, these gasoline, diesel-burning vehicles. So we are going to dig into that and find out what kind of answers we can get coming up next as we sit in for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. I think this song is making me uncomfortable. This is a 70s song, or 70s artist, certainly.
Yeah.
And in the 7 o'clock hour, we do songs from the 70s here on The Commute with Carlson.
Any guests on the band doing this?
If you had not told me, I never would have gotten close to this.
Go ahead, tell them who it is.
Jethro Tull?
Jethro
and this
Tull.
Is a Christmas song?
Yeah, it's called Ring Out. Solstice Bells.
Solstice Bells, okay. And I think the solstice comes up on the 21st.
Christmas stations came out, Phil. 200 Saturday? Stations at one point. Everybody thought, there's money to be made. Let's make a Christmas album, no matter how old or how young we are, and contribute to stations like here locally, Warm FM. And
sometimes the best decisions are the ones you don't make. I'm not in the target demo for Jethro Tull, which probably underscores the comment you just heard there. Hi, everybody. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer. John's out today and tomorrow, and Mark, Christopher, and I are sitting in. I talked about this story yesterday on the show on one of the social media sweep segments that Cairo Television, Channel 7, is reporting that the EPA, the Biden administration, is giving $8.4 million to the state of Washington to buy 28 electric vehicles. But these are not cars. These are what we'll call, for lack of a better term, big rigs. And a lot of them are going to be buses, some for school districts, some for the Department of Ecology. I'm still not clear on why the Department of Ecology needs buses, but essentially it's going to replace heavy-duty vehicles like school buses, garbage trucks, with more green alternatives as part of the Channel 7 story. It's 28 vehicles, and here's how it breaks down. The Washington Department of Ecology is going to get $3.8 million to buy electric buses to replace 13 school buses. And again, I don't know why the Washington Department of Ecology is trafficking in all of this. It sounds like they're the middleman almost. I don't know why the Department of Ecology would need school buses per se. Are these transit buses? I don't know. The story doesn't get into that. The Confederated Tribe of Colville Reservation is getting $260,000 to replace a diesel garbage truck with one electric one. And then the Woodland Public School District down in Southwest Washington is getting $4.2 million to replace 14 diesel buses. So Mark and I were talking about this off the air. He goes, you know what? My brother, for the longest time, has driven motor coaches. These are the big Greyhound type tour type buses that you might see for the rock and roll band or doing that kind of interstate travel with a Greyhound type of a bus.
This started, Phil, too. Bob was part of the pilot program when Crystal Mountain thought, well, maybe we should do like reserve parking, but can we work with the King County Fairgrounds and Enumclaw and do bus shuttles? And Bob was like the captain of these VIP coaches.
So Bob has been around the bus driving world, and Bob has even been on test drives with EV buses. So we thought, Bob, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good
Thanks
morning,
for coming
you guys.
On to talk, but you've had this experience of test driving, being on a ride-along on an EV bus, and we thought, tell us how this works. Are these going to be a reasonable replacement for the diesel buses the way the politicians and the bureaucrats and the activists who want to reduce carbon emissions think they will.
Well, I tell you, my first impression, I'm going to be honest, the buses, we came out of this one trial going up to the, and the first thing we noticed is that there's very little cargo space under the motor coach.
Okay.
Almost 80% of the capacity was taken to battery. So that's our drawback right there.
Yeah, the battery's got to go somewhere.
Exactly. And then, of course, in my first electric vehicle was in 1980 with an electric forklift. I was working for a major carrier. And the first thing I noted was as soon as you let off the throttle, the vehicle stops.
Yes.
So you could be in the middle of your highway and you're going to lose your speed. And all of a sudden, you're now a target for somebody behind you.
Yeah, it's regenerative braking, I think, is the term it uses.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other drawback with the forklift was I'm lifting these heavy electronic computers and every time I'm raising and lowering, it's drawn on the same battery. So my direction here is that if they do, in fact, want to have these vehicles, they need to do something different with the batteries. Maybe having two batteries, one charge the other. And Mark will remember, our dad had a Volkswagen bus. He actually wired his car with two batteries, so one would charge the other when he switched over batteries.
Uh-huh.
And this kept us full power. Not that the vehicle was running electric at that time, but any that was drawing the power wasn't going to be reduced because the battery wearing down. The other battery was there to keep charging. It could switch over to the other battery when the other one was starting to show low amperage. But I will tell you, on the way up the hill, we saw slow speed. And if you put people on these big rig buses, as you call them, that's more draw on the power as far as pushing weight up the hill.
Climbing hills,
So then the other component here is pricing. Now, I've driven these buses that come out of the motor coach industries, Van Hools, Prevost, whatnot. And ideally, your diesel models are around $700,000 for a brand new bus.
Okay.
And if you buy a fleet, of course, the price comes down, discount price. But the electronic model was starting at $1.2 million. And I tried to get an opinion out of the owner of the company riding the bus with me. And I finally broke out and I said, are you seriously going to consider buying one of these buses at the price and the lack of space? Oh, of course not. But maybe in 10 years when they get more space and smaller batteries and they can go farther range and whatnot. Because at that time, the bus we had, the model, the range was 250 miles distance. Okay. And that's on flat roads. That's not inclines or any kind of unique environment with struggle.
Hauling passengers and weight.
Exactly. And for what it's worth, Mark was asking me yesterday, what about your over-the-road trips, long-distance convoys, things of that nature? I said, exactly. They're more of a nuisance because now you're going to have to figure out maybe having swapped vehicles at a point in the road and this kind of thing. So there's real expense to all this. The efficiency and speed and control is really the priority.
What was recharge time, Bob, after maybe a bus running up to Crystal back and forth or a shuttle to the ski resort after running what was the limit, over 200 miles? How long would it take to recharge all the batteries?
They would. The estimate was minimum 4 hours.
Okay.
So you've got a lot of downtime, just like your cars. My wife and I lived in Centralia. We had a charging station. I would see cars there, and I'm thinking, gosh, if these people didn't have an outlet mall to escape to, they just sit in their car for 4 hours, you know, waiting for a charge. But again, I just feel the technology isn't there. Now, let me remind you, when Mark and I grew up in Seattle, Metro, formerly Seattle Transit System, had electronic trolley buses. These were great. They had overhead wires.
Yeah, the overhead wire system,
And we lived on Queen Anne Hill, and I tell you, those buses didn't struggle going up the counterbalance, one of the steepest hills in Seattle. So maybe the old ways to consider. And one other option, I'll tell you what I did, and was a solar bus. And what was nice about the solar bus, which they're still...
Uh-oh, your phone was cutting out a little bit. But yeah, solar bus, solar-powered?
Solar panel buses, and panels up on the roof. And these buses would run tandem with your diesel motors. So you push back and forth. And the one part that's weird, normally at the end of shift, you turn your batteries off for the motor coach. But the solar, you just don't turn them off. Let them keep charging.
Okay, so it kind of works as a supplement.
Exactly.
In that respect,
so you have
for diesel
a reduction
engine.
In costs. You're not using all the diesel fuel up. But again, this is real pioneering stages, in my opinion. But to just throw us into something that, you know, catalyst to a full charge bus, it's not going to do the range. So again, ideally, these buses would be perfect for, let's say, a town like North Bend that doesn't have a hill and just keep them in the low flat.
Fire safety, Bob. Anything did you hear about batteries having faulty situations or maybe like a battery charger?
Well, that's good you bring that up, Mark, because I just saw this in the fire department use an example of all these things exploding in apartments and things like that. These batteries that are being created are still not mastered to the point of knowing 100% their durability and safety. And my first thought was, boy, if I'm out on the road and I have a battery issue that goes into a fire mode or whatnot. Our buses were designed with a fire suppression system for the diesel motors, but now you're talking electronic batteries that explode, and how much time do you have to get passengers out the windows and whatnot? There still needs to be more time in the lab.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the liabilities, is the lithium ion batteries that power these vehicles. Should they result in a fire or some sort of fire breakout that burns so hot and so intensely, firefighters have basically said you've just basically got to stay away from it and let it burn itself out over a little bit of time. You can't just automatically rush in and try and suppress that fire reflexively.
You have to get a special charger. You can't just take the average battery charger like we know for the standard batteries we have and put them on these lithium batteries. Otherwise, that would create the fires. Bob was saying with a recent story.
Electronic forklift. I had a 1980. I had appendicitis. I was weak. Another warehouse person took over and neglected to charge that. What they were described as tank, a big military tanks were this had like 32 cells. You had to fill every day those water cells. Otherwise, that battery became null and void. And
Bob,
why am I thinking Bob's got a lithium battery in his phone?
The phone is cutting out a little bit.
We don't want to catch fire.
We're kind of running out of time in this segment, but your perspective and your experience has been beneficial, because this is kind of adds to what we know a little bit about, you know, standard passenger vehicles that are EVs, like the Teslas and those sorts of things. That they've got certain applications where they fit in very well, and then others where they don't. And it sounds like the similar thing going on for these EV-powered buses.
And one other thing to consider is winter weather, and whether or not if the resort were to buy buses, which they proposed they were going to, where would they store them? There's another expense, things of that nature you don't think about.
Well, we've been talking to Bob Thielen, and this is Mark Christopher's brother, but Bob has worked for years and years as a motor coach driver, driving buses, and had a chance to be on a test drive of an EV bus. And Washington State is getting a grant, or, well, I guess it's not so much a grant, it's getting $8.4 million from the Biden administration to get EV buses going here in this state. And that's why we wanted to talk to Bob about his experience, so that you could hear a little bit more about it. Bob, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on the show this morning as we sit in for John Carlson, and have a fantastic Christmas.
And you too. And just know the buses running today are a lot more efficient, less polluting, and wonderful until that day comes when they do have full electric. Yeah.
Sure. We get that vehicle that is a more perfect combination of non-polluting and still able to have range and hauling power and space and all that good stuff.
I'm always ready to go back to a horse. You never saw traffic jams with horses.
I guess so. I guess so. All right. Bob Thielen, thank you very much for joining us here this morning on KVI. And yeah, I think this answer that we've kind of heard previously about EVs, the passenger EVs, for some people, it's going to be the right answer.
Well, you mean like
if you're talking about school buses as EVs, okay, that probably makes some sense.
And last week we talked about RVs and how they're looking at those now to make them all better.
Yeah.
Talk to the drivers.
But,
talk to the consumers that use these rigs. And like what Bob was saying, it's just like, I don't know.
But yeah, as this nation faces trillions and trillions of dollars of deficit, and we've got DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, coming online with the Trump administration, $8 million for buses right now, those are the sorts of things that are going to come up for review with DOGE. And they're going to wonder, hey, is it really worth it to spend 60-70% more on a vehicle like a school bus that's electric vehicle just so that we can cut down on carbon emissions. And that's going to be one of the decisions that DOGE is going to have to deal with, amongst others, as the Trump administration gets into power next year. All right. We'll continue along on the John Carlson Show. Point Defiance Park in Tacoma. Another attack on a woman in Point Defiance Park. We just had another one a little bit earlier this year. That's one of the stories we'll get to as we continue in for John Carlson on KVI. Carlson this morning here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. I'm Phil Vandervoort, his producer, Mark Christopher, the radio legend, along with me this morning. John will be back for Thursday's show, so we'll be in tomorrow as well. We were just talking about the electric vehicle buses. The state getting $8.3 or $8.4 million from the Biden administration's EPA to buy 28 electric buses and one electric garbage truck. That works out to be about $300,000 for each one of those vehicles. And as it pertains to this mania for getting EVs to replace gas or diesel-powered vehicles, Governor Inslee has been at the forefront of all of this. And, you know, he's the one that's lobbying the Biden administration to do this sort of stuff and get $8 million into the state for these EV vehicles and buses, most specifically. The Associated Press has a story that's going to be a bit of a problem for Governor Inslee. And the headline in the Associated Press story says that in Nigeria's lithium boom, because you need lithium mined out of the earth to power lithium-ion batteries that make up these batteries for electric vehicles, in Nigeria's lithium boom, many mines are illegal and children do much of the work. So now there's an element of child labor exploitation, child labor in an effort to try and generate lithium that you need for these EVs. And I'll get into that story next and explain what's going on with this Associated Press report out of Nigeria coming up next here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Cruising along on a Tuesday.
Is it still that dark outside right now? Isn't it the third hour?
No, I think we're hitting sunrise. You just can't see it.
I can't tell if it's because the lights in our building make it look darker outside. I don't know.
Wind,
I know it's supposed to be cloudy and kind of
snow. You were saying it was going to
atmospheric river. That means clouds and rain. But
as you get started for this 8 o'clock hour, I'm gonna see if we can hold a Shannon O'Donnell to talk about this atmospheric river thing and snow. And
we can maybe narrow down if you're gonna win this little wager that you've kind of brought up about snow on Christmas next week. Hi, everybody. Phil Vandervoort here, John Carlson's producer, in for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI, along with Mark Christopher, the radio legend there. We've just been talking about this electric vehicle situation, state of Washington getting a bunch of money from the Biden EPA to buy $8.4 million worth of electric buses and one electric garbage truck. And I wanted to add to that story story I saw from the Associated Press just a couple of days ago. And it's a story out of Nigeria. And in Nigeria, they are mining lithium because you need lithium for these lithium-ion batteries to power these electric vehicles. And the Associated Press story says, in Nigeria, the lithium boom, many mines are illegal and children do much of the work. And it shows some pictures of some Nigerian kids in the sandals, and they're basically walking around with chunks of what seem to be lithium. They're not in what you'd normally, I think, associate with a mine. They're not underground. They're not down in a shaft or a tunnel or anything like that. It's almost like a quarry. Maybe that's the other way to explain it. And they've got these what look like burlap type bags. They might be repurposing rice bags or something like that when you get the big 5-10 pound rice bag. And so the pictures of these children, they're walking around holding these bags, and they're trying to break off pieces of rock that are lithium, and then they're, you know, collecting the lithium pieces. And as Governor Inslee is implementing this Climate Commitment Act and trying to jack up the price of gasoline to make it more expensive so that people will use less of it, and pushing people towards electric vehicles, unfortunately, this is looking like one of the results. And according to the Associated Press story, you've got the International Labor Organization estimating that more than 1 million children work in mines and quarries worldwide, a problem particularly acute in Africa, where poverty, limited access to education, and weak regulations add to the problem. children working mostly in small-scale mines, working long hours, unsafe sites, crushing or sorting rocks, carrying heavy loads of ore, and exposing themselves to toxic dust that could potentially cause respiratory problems and asthma. And that's been the justification for we've got to have the Climate Commitment Act. Do you remember the campaign ads back in November and October for the initiative 2117? All of the opposition ads to 2117, which would have repealed that carbon auction permit scheme that is the cornerstone of the Climate Commitment Act. It complained about, oh, wow, if this gets reversed and this gets voted down, we're going to have more kids in Western Washington. They're going to have respiratory problems because of all the tailpipe emissions from the cars, even though the state of Washington doesn't bother to test the tailpipe emissions of cars anymore because we've realized that most of the newer cars that are on the road don't crank out a lot of tailpipe emissions. But that didn't stop them from phrasing it that way in all those opposition ads. And I'm sure that scared and frightened a fair amount of voters, and ultimately Initiative 2117 to repeal the Climate Commitment Act's portion of this carbon emissions auction pricing ended up failing in the ballot back in November. And so this is the report from the Associated Press that you've got these kids that are basically working to mine and produce lithium. Now, I'll add a couple of wrinkles to this. These are probably not the lithium sources. They're going to get used in a lot of the cars that would get sold in the United States. And here's why. China has created all kinds of contracts and all kinds of economic connections to mine natural resources and minerals like that in African nations. And China has been going to all kinds of different nations in Africa to say, hey, look, you have all these natural resources. We can come in and we can help come up with the money to mine these, and then you'll get a cut and we'll get the natural resources that we want for things like, you know, they want to build stuff in China. They want to build EV vehicles. And China is one of the biggest right now for sales of EVs. That's they're really kind of the worldwide leader right now for producing and buying and selling electric vehicles. So my suspicion would be that a lot of this, based on the story out of the Associated Press of Nigerian lithium mining, they would these resources would be going to China and not coming to the United States, for instance, or wherever Tesla's building their cars here in the States, or other EV makers that sell a lot domestically in the United States. So these, you know, exploited Nigerian kids, that's probably going to be more closely associated with what's going on with China and their production for EVs. And then I can add one teeny tiny little story that says electric car sales are slowing in the United States and Europe, but they are still increasing quite rapidly in China. And this is another Associated Press story that came out at the tail end of November. And the big problem is cost remains an issue for more mainstream American consumers of EV makers, according to polling by the Associated Press. And here's kind of an example. EV sales plunged in Germany earlier this year after the government abruptly canceled the purchase premium, or the subsidy of 6,700 euros for up to $40,000 for an EV vehicle, 40,000 euros. So that means that most internal combustion models, according to the Associated Press, are a better deal over a car's lifetime. And if it doesn't pencil out, you're not going to buy that more expensive EV. So there's the dilemma as EV sales are starting to dry up, something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, keeping the eye on the weather out there. And I'm wondering, okay, if I have an EV car and I get on an EV ferry and then I drive home, I
can have on an EV bus.
A long road going home. All right, brings to mind, got to bring on our good friend Shannon O'Donnell, chief meteorologist, Como 4 TV, live doing the news this morning. Actually, I was going to get a hold of you, Shannon, because I think I need to take a video of you doing a snow dance, because you got the ultimate snow dance, so we can guarantee my prediction of snow Christmas Day, but that's a week away.
Mark really wants that, Shannon.
we
I want not just snow in the mountains, and it's getting actually worrisome. And I know you're, you know, so glad that it snowed so much over the last couple of days. Are you guys there?
Yeah, we're here. Absolutely. So, yeah, and we're looking at all this weather. So, what's going on with this mess now after Saturday and all the winds too?
So, what are we facing here and up in the mountains?
It's just pretty messy out there, and unfortunately, the storm we had over the weekend, while it was windy, and of course Whidbey Island was having to bear the brunt of that with the power outages and whatnot, at least it was nice and cold, and we just got such a solid coating of winter white up in the Cascades that we were, you know, opening Snoqualmie Summit today on a couple of runs. So great news. I wish the great news would continue, because it stays very, very wet around here, but we're going in the complete wrong direction in terms of the temperature profile and therefore the snow levels the next couple of days. So it's going to be kind of tough around here.
So is this just a temporary swing? Do you get the sense that in the next couple of weeks we'll have this dropping snow level in the Cascades and then rising snow level? Or is there a way to know?
Couple of weeks, sure. But here in the short term, for the next week, all the way through Christmas Eve, it's looking like one round of warm rain after the next. And so often when we get an atmospheric river, it comes through, we get a day or two of the really warm rain, and then it's over and it gets really chilly again. This one, we don't cut off this plume of moisture that just wants to keep pumping in from the subtropics. And so today is just round one, where we see the snow level tonight shoot up to about 7,000 to 8,000 feet after dark tonight. Way high, I know. But we get round after round like this, and winter officially begins on Saturday. And actually, that's the warmest day of the bunch. It looks like we'll be in the 50s to near 60.
Shannon, with all the rain we've had, where I live over at Hood Canal, as you know, we've had a lot of the salmon spawning, and now they're washed down because of all the rain. Are we worried if we live near a river that ends in ish, Skokomish, Snohomish, and all this?
Most of them, right? Or any, like Snoqualmie. But yes, Skokomish is the infamous one with the salmon crossing the road jokes, right? That's the spot really highlighted for the worst of the potential flooding, Mason County. My good friend Rich Marriott at King always joked about, if a cow spits, the Skokomish River is under a flood warning, because it happens so easily there in the farmland there around Mason County and Potlatch and whatnot. The Skokomish is always the first to go, the first to flood, the last to go back under and stay within its banks. And this time, with these rounds of atmospheric rivers coming through, they're really focusing on the Olympics. So you just got all of that heavy snow up there. So that's all sitting up there. Then you rain on top of that. The rain all comes tumbling down the sides of the Olympics. It melts the snow, so it brings that down too. And then you also have the heavy rain down at the base. So three sources of water coming into these basins, into the rivers, and they go high and fast really quickly. So I think we're heading into
that. Any wind worry, like with all this rain, like what we saw last Saturday, Shannon O'Donnell?
Not quite as severe today, but we are under a high wind warning for the South Washington coastline. That's Long Beach. So gusts there to 60. They're used to that. That's right in line with, it's gusty, right? And then the rest of the Washington coast, including La Push, Ocean Shores, Tohola, and whatnot, and the Northwest Interior, this includes Whidbey Island again, Bellingham, San Juan's, a wind advisory for winds gusting 50 to 55. So, right back into the gusty business today as well.
All right. Well, I think that covers it. Great update, Shannon. Thank you for taking a moment to share it all with us. Como 4 meteorologist Shannon O'Donnell.
Yeah, share a snow dance video, too, if you want. I'll post it.
I think we need to. We need to do some serious snow dancing at this point. Get things going back in the right direction, guys.
So what you're saying is that the snow on Christmas Day next week is probably unlikely.
Not so likely. And in fact, as we head into Monday and Tuesday, there's a big storm. At least, this is a week out or a little bit less than a week out at this point. Next Monday, it looks like a really deep area of low pressure again. So it looks really gusty, really warm. I'm just hoping at this rate we can have power on on Christmas because these storms are just so insistent on making a beeline toward Western Washington.
The more realistic concern. Okay. Yeah. Shannon, great update. Thank you for taking time to speak with us this morning.
Anytime. Happy to help.
Thank you, my friend. See you on TV.
Quick story I want to share about Shannon, her mentor, Steve Poole.
Yeah.
Years ago when my girls were young and I lived in Magnolia, we knew, oh, no, it's going to be in the 50s and we got rain coming for Christmas, So I had our brother-in-law, Steve, over in Yakima. I said, fill your pickup with snow. Cover it. Bring it in. I'll get the kids out in the yard, do a snow dance in their snow clothes, whatever, and we were just raining and wet in Magnolia. They came inside. He showed up, unloaded the truck, snow all over the front yard. They started going out, wow, look at it work, Dad. It snowed Dan's whole bit.
Imported the snow.
Right. So then it got a little slushy. We went inside, stayed warm, had the evening. That night, something happened and changed. We had 12 inches of snow that night.
Wait, what?
For Christmas Day. The people, Steve from Yakima, couldn't get home. He had to stay for 2 days. The result, he's a carpenter. I got a new bathroom out of it.
Oh, golly.
Many of you remember this. Back in the 90s, we had that freak snowstorm. It just,
it's a Christmas miracle.
Dance, man. I'm telling you, Phil, I need your snow dance.
All righty, Santa. Thank you so much. Have a great week. All righty. In for John Carlson this morning, I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, Mark Christopher with the Christmas history in the Greater Magnolia section of Seattle there. we've got socialists on social media coming up, and we're going to bring in young Zach again. I got something else that I wanted to talk to young Zach about, and it has to do with Blue Sky. We talked just ever so a little bit about the alternative to X or Twitter, and the guy who founded it, Twitter initially, and then sold that off to Elon Musk. He started up a new social media platform. It's called Blue Sky. And Blue Sky is running into problems with death threats to people who are more conservative on Blue Sky. And the deep irony here is that Blue Sky was created so that people on the political left didn't like what was going on X after Elon Musk bought it and kind of stopped so much of the censorship that was going on X. All the political people on the left were complaining that, well, X is just too toxic now. We need to start our own platform. We need to have our own social media outlet, and that it was going to be all puppy dogs and sunshine over on this new platform called Blue Sky. Well, lo and behold, the toxicity is now turning into death threats if you don't agree with the crowd over at Blue Sky. So that's something that we'll get into here at the bottom of the hour with young Zach, who helps us run the show and does so much stuff behind the scenes for us here on Talk Radio 570 KVI between Ari's show, Ari Hoffman, afternoons 3 to 6, and John Carlson's show, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. here. So that's coming up. And then, of course, we got socialists on social media coming up next. And it looks like Canada is fit to be tied right now between the current prime minister and a possible challenger to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. So that's something that we'll get into coming up next here on the social media sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI. There's my Christmas jam. Christmas rapping by the Waitresses, early 80s. It's a brother and sister combination that were in this band. Female lead singer, and then I think her brother played guitar or something like that. In for John Carlson this morning here. Merry Christmas. And happy holidays and happy new year. And we'll start Hanukkah next week on Christmas night. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Commute with Carlson this morning. John's out today and tomorrow, but he'll be back for Thursday. So definitely stick around with us today, tomorrow, and just be ready for John's return on Thursday. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. Mark Christopher, the radio legend here in the studio.
We have fun doing this, yeah. Too, by the way. Yeah. Thank you, everybody, because you know you get used to that voice of Carlson to wake you up, and a little different with Phil and I, but you know, we're the backbone of the big guy.
Exactly. So we're always here taking care of business during John's show, and then young Zach's going to join us here in a couple minutes. He always helps run the show on Thursday and Friday. He does all kinds of stuff on Ari Hoffman's show in the afternoon. But we've got a story I got to run past young Zach that has to do with what's kind of being billed as the alternative to the social media platform X. Now that Elon Musk owns it, of course, the liberals don't want to have anything to do with it. The Democrats don't want to be part of X anymore. And there is a new social media platform that has started up that's selling itself, billing itself as just, you know, liberal Twitter is what they're kind of calling it, or bringing back liberal Twitter. So we'll get into that coming up after the bottom of the hour traffic report about 8:35 this morning. Now, we got to get you to the social media sweep, socialists on social media. This one's sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And Attorney General Bob Ferguson is posting about a lawsuit that the Attorney General's office joined into. And it went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So this appellate level decision, and in a unanimous opinion, the Ninth Circuit Court threw out a challenge to state law that dealt with sports betting. And there was a private company that basically wanted to get its foot in the door to be able to do non-tribal reservation sports gambling, sports betting. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, you're not allowed to do that in the state of Washington. And so Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office essentially prevailed in this case. And Bob Ferguson is applauding the court and basically taking a victory lap to say, hey, look, we won this court decision against this company that wanted to do sports betting. And that case has now been dismissed. It released a press release and everything. And it's odd because here's Bob Ferguson bragging about allowing or bragging about a court case that prevents competition in the marketplace for sports betting. But a week ago, Bob Ferguson was bragging about preventing a monopoly when it came to a grocery store merger. So it looks like Bob Ferguson is trying to play both sides of the same coin here. He's applauding a legal ruling on one side that prevents a grocery store merger because he said, hell, if that would have been allowed to go through, that would have created a grocery store monopoly. But here he's applauding a legal ruling that allows a lack of competition in the state of Washington as it relates to sports betting. So typical Bob Ferguson, trying to have it both ways. Now, speaking of grocery store prices, Elizabeth Warren, socialist. I guess she's a bit of a socialist, isn't she? But I should have said senator from the state of Massachusetts, U.S. senator. And she posted, candidate Trump promised to lower grocery prices, but now it seems he isn't even going to try. While champagne corks pop at Mar-a-Lago, President-elect Trump says that he can't really lower grocery prices because it's very hard. Sad. It's the start of a broken promise. Well, I got to tell you, Senator Warren, you should travel out here to the state of Washington if you want to talk about grocery store prices. And one of those things that also happened, have you been to the grocery store in the last 2 or 3 days, Mark?
Oh, yeah.
I was daily. Grocery shopping last night. The wife says, we need eggs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Even for the bargain basement grocery store 18-pack of eggs. She wants 18 eggs. Don't ask why. Mm-hmm. A dozen is not going to cut it. We need 18 at my house.
Yep.
And the grocery store 18 carton of eggs in North Seattle, $8.89.
Wow, that's a high one.
18 eggs.
Yeah.
And if you want to get 12 eggs of the, you know, farm, you know, free range, mm-hmm. all that other stuff, it's $10 for 12. So you've got eggs that are basically a buck each in the state of Washington. Now, this is not specific to Washington. This is all related to bird flu problems and egg farmers and chicken ranchers and chicken farmers and everything. They're having to kill some of the flock and stuff like that, and that's driving up the price. But it's maddening.
Yeah.
And so I paid $10 because I know my wife will not like the store version. I had to buy the upgraded version. I paid over $10 for 18 eggs last night.
I'm grateful because where I live in the canal, we have a lot of people with chickens, and they put the little booth out, you know, the honor system, $5.
That's
$5
cool.
Dozen eggs. Now when you drive by, it's like sold out all the time. Now you know why. And I wish there was a way that they could like restrict, like, okay, come on, $5 bargain, one dozen, but some people taking 3, 4, 5, and then the rest of us are left out. But good job to those homeowners that have the chickens, and thank you for making that effort to help us out. A little bit. We just got to control.
And then, of course, you want to buy anything that's made out of eggs. You need cookies or cakes or something like that. Forget it. You know, that's going to impact those things as well. Okay, I got one more. I got to get in here because I promised this Canada thing. And this is about Canada's Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, might have a vote of no confidence coming up shortly. So somebody posted on X and said, as a Canadian, I'm not worried about Justin Trudeau, who I think is very flawed, if he resigns. I am worried about who's going to be the next prime minister. If it's the conservative candidate from the opposition party in Canada, Pierre Poilievre, we're bleeping doomed. That bleeping bleep's going to let Trump turn Canada into the 51st state, and that scares me. All right, Canada, don't say you weren't warned. So, all righty. So now I've got that one in for you as well. Okay. We're going to examine death threats that are coming up on the alternative to the social media platform X, because Blue Sky, this alternative social media platform, was supposed to be the kindler, gentler X, because X was toxic, because too many conservatives were on X after Elon Musk took it over. So we're going to get into that coming up next here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. And I wanted to bring young Zach onto the program because Zach was the one that got me turned on to the new quote-unquote liberal Twitter, liberal X, but it's a site called Blue Sky. And Blue Sky was created by, is it Jack Norton? Is that the fella's name?
Yeah, the original.
The guy who started Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
And this Blue Sky just opened up in the last month or two?
Maybe longer? I think it's been open for a while. It's gained popularity in the last month or two because of ever since Elon Musk took over Twitter.
Yeah, and so in the backlash to everything Elon Musk, all the liberals that used to populate
Jack
Twitter.
Jack Dorsey,
thank you. So Jack Dorsey created Blue Sky as this oasis for the people on the political left that didn't want to be part of Elon Musk's platform. And so a bunch of people have migrated over to Blue Sky. And part of the answer was, oh, Blue Sky, it's not toxic the way X
It's not your toxic
is.
X.
Exactly. So that was the basis for Blue Sky's creation and operation and trying to get people to migrate over to their site and away from Elon Musk's. And there's a controversy right now involving Blue Sky because of death threats. If you don't stick to the orthodoxy and the viewpoint of people that tend to dominate Blue Sky, who are the people on the political left. So hotair.com is a conservative political blog, and they have this story that they posted yesterday, Blue Sky's death threat problem. And I'll give you the old how it started, how it's going, because that's a popular way to describe what's happening on the world of social media. And it starts with a guy named Jesse Singel, who's a podcast co-host and is a former New York Magazine writer. And he is a skeptic of the trans gender-affirming care subject matter and orthodoxy. And so he had compiled a whole list of how he was responded to for the things that he was posting on Blue Sky. And here's one of the responses to the things that he posted about questioning gender-affirming care and things like that and how this could be detrimental to young people. And one of the responses to what he posted on Blue Sky goes like this. Honestly, banning Jesse Singel would probably be in his best interest too. The more he keeps tormenting people, the more likely it is that one of them will snap and end his life. He is safest when we don't have to think about him. So that's what somebody posted, indicating that someone should try and end Jesse Singel's life. And Jesse Singel kind of relayed a bunch of this stuff on his X account and said, all the death threats are couched in the idea that I pose an imminent risk or threat to that community on Blue Sky. And that's the line. That I'm putting users there at Blue Sky at risk. No one can explain how. And he writes, NBC News is actually working on an article with that angle based on the request for comment that they sent me. So after this sort of implied death threat or implied threat that someone should step forward and try and attack this guy and or kill this guy, NBC is now trying to report on what's going on. So that's kind of the how it started. Let me see. Oh, yeah, here's one more response on Blue Sky to this guy, Jesse Singel, who does not go along with the gender-affirming care authority of trans activists. And this person's account is named Pyramid Chad, whatever that means. He writes, I don't think Blue Sky should ban Jesse Singel as a speech platform. It should take a neutral stance towards the expression of views. And my view is, if Jesse were beaten to death with a hammer, we wouldn't have to see his posts. That's just my opinion. So there's a little bit of the animosity that's supposed to be over at this liberal, accepting, tolerant oasis called Blue Sky. Have you kind of bumped into any of this stuff yet, or have you been following any of this controversy?
I didn't know it had gotten to that level. I reposted. Yeah. So KVI does have a blue sky. We have two followers. You know, for any of our liberal listeners, Kevin, Jeff, looking at you, toss us a follow. I know you're out there on blue sky.
There's a couple.
All the haters. So I posted, reposted this thing I saw was pretty funny. It says, if you're a troll on Blue Sky, we don't talk, we block. Implying we'll block your account.
And that's something that you could do on X.
Opposed to the idea that Twitter is, you know, people get in these Twitter fights. So I've certainly seen that mentality of this is not a free speech zone. This is our little, quote, safe space, and we don't want you here, and we're not going to participate in any sort of, you know, conversation or disagreement. So that is certainly a tone that resonates throughout the whole platform.
I'll be honest. I don't get a lot of the whole transgender activism stuff. I don't know why you'd try and push a kid in that direction. I don't get that at all. But, you know, to each their own. I will add that meanwhile, after we went through the death threat related stuff that has been happening to this guy who's a skeptic of transgender, gender-affirming care and all those things, Jesse Singel, guess what the Washington Post is doing? The Washington Post is sounding the alarm about the lack of strong evidence for providing children, minors, with gender transition treatments like puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgeries, arguing that there is, quote, reason to worry, end quote, about the use of those things. The Washington Post published an editorial, and they weighed in on the underlying medical question in this case that just went to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is called the United States versus Scrimeti, and this is the Biden administration's legal challenge to a Tennessee law that outlaws the prescription of these puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and gender-affirming care surgeries to minors. So after submitting that Tennessee has a claim before the court, the editorial board at the Washington Post went on to say that it would be ludicrous to suggest that patients have a civil right to be harmed by ineffective medical interventions, and likewise unconscionable for the state of Tennessee to deny a treatment that improves patients' lives, even if the state did so with majestic impartiality. The issue is subject to legal dispute in part because the medical questions have not been properly resolved. So those are the words of the Washington Post that are essentially putting the brakes and trying to call out the transgender activism world.
How the turntables.
Yeah. So for all of this vitriol over on Blue Sky, I guess these are going to be more of the people that are not going to subscribe to the Washington Post. After they refused to make an endorsement in the presidential election between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. So thank goodness that the Washington Post is kind of coming at this with a reasoned eye. And they're pointing out that, hey, if these surgeries, these treatments, these puberty blockers and things like that have not really been properly resolved, no one should be advocating that young kids go through this.
I would like to say this about Blue Sky as a platform at large, though. I can't say that we are should be surprised that a essentially completely liberal dominated space has taken this turn. I mean, this is essentially, think of everything that happened at the Chaz Chop Zone. Think of how violent that turned in real life.
And how they moved to suppress information from coming out that it was viewpoints that they didn't like.
Their little utopias never go quite as planned.
Well, it's,
so you scale that up to millions of users. Okay. I don't know how many active users. There are a lot of these social media accounts, you know, you'll hear these inflated numbers. For example, KVI has an account. I wouldn't call us a user.
Yeah.
But there's still millions of people actively using this platform. Yeah. And what do you know? It becomes a toxic wasteland of violence and hatred.
It's a utopia for the deepest, most sincere believers, but not many others. So, Zach, great stuff. Thank you for joining us here
as we all sit in
for Carlson and talk about the big switch of liberals moving off of the X platform because they don't like Elon Musk and trying to go over to their little utopia called Blue Sky. So we're keeping an eye on it for you. It's It's a lot to keep track of. If you've got a comment, and we've got lots of comments rolling in on the text line, but if something that you heard in the last hour or so of the show, any of our stuff on the EVs or the lithium mining in Nigeria, any of that stuff, jump in on the KVI text line 206-421-5757, and we can throw out your comments here as we get them in the last segment of the show before Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins.
Speaking of small town, Kenny G comes home for 5 nights at the Jazz Alley here during the holiday season. Okay. That'd be a good Christmas gift here. Franklin High while I was at Queen Anne. He was learning his music, I was learning mine, but Kenny G coming home.
Smooth jazz Christmas there. Okay. Yeah. Mark Christopher there, Phil Vandervoort here sitting in for John Carlson this morning. Earlier on the show, we were talking about the tax in Gig Harbor on women in the Costco parking lot, this kind of crime of cowards going after some of the most vulnerable people, in this case, older women, robbing them of their purses. In Tacoma, Point Defiance Park, this is just the incredible park on the northern tip of North Tacoma, overlooking the waters of the Narrows Passage and out to Vashon Island and things like that. Another woman has been sexually assaulted this week. And this is the second time this has happened, probably in the last 6 months, I believe. It was over the summer, maybe late spring. Now officials are considering putting up permanent surveillance cameras, according to Como News.
In the past, park officials have tried adjusting park hours and having temporary cameras at park entrances after violent incidents, including a shooting that injured a child last year and a woman who was violently stabbed multiple times on a park trail earlier this year.
They served as a visual deterrent, but for purposes of what the police needed for digital evidence for crime control or for establishing case, they weren't of quality enough. And we need to have a digital footprint of folks that enter the park and where they go.
Park officials say police have provided a report of around 12 to 15 locations to install permanent cameras, and they'll be turning to security companies for information and proposals on a more comprehensive security system for park safety.
We simply can't have our crown jewel park fall victim to this type of activity. It's unacceptable.
And in addition, parks officials tell me they do have two security officers that patrol the park pretty much 24/7. But as far as adding more, they say that they'll continue to work with police to evaluate their security needs here.
That's Como 4's Lynn Ann Wynn on that report about the latest attack at Point Defiance. And two officers to patrol sounds good, but it's a huge park. There's a ton of area to cover. And two, even 24 hours a day, I mean, the response times would be pretty quick, I'd guess. But, man, I don't know if that's going to be enough to discourage attackers there. And that's what it comes back to. We're going to need cameras now to try and capture who's coming and going, video of them, in case something horrific does happen. But that's the latest update on the security concerns out at Point Defiance Park there in Tacoma. That wraps it up for us here on The Commute with Carlson. Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins are coming up next. Tomorrow, John Carlson will be out again, but Mark Christopher and I will be here. We'll do legendary lyrics, so make sure you join us for that. Listen to win. You have a chance to win a $50 Daniels gift card and an Almond Roca prize pack perfectly in time for the new year. That's great. And Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins are coming up next. Lars Larson at noon. And Ari Hoffman for 3 to 6 here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Have a great Tuesday.